Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And now that we've heard some arguments for and against the constitutionality of stop and frisk, here might be the most heretical argument of all, that the Constitution is overrated. It comes from Georgetown Law Professor Lewis Michael Seidman, author of a book called On Constitutional Obedience. And I'm going to check that. It's called On Constitutional Disobedience, a little different. Or maybe you saw his Times op-ed along the same lines called Let's Give Up on the Constitution. Professor Seidman, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Well, it's Mike, and thank you so much for having me, Brian. I'm a big fan of your show.
Thank you. To be crystal clear for our listeners, you say you're not in favor of revising the Constitution. You're in favor of ignoring it. Really?
Well, that's a heck of a way to start the discussion. Yes, really. I really mean this. You know, it might be useful maybe just to pick up where you left off with the discussion you were just having, because I think that's a useful illustration. So, in fact, if you look at the Fourth Amendment itself, the framers of the Fourth Amendment had no idea what a stop and frisk was. At the time the Fourth Amendment was written, there was no organized police force. The Fourth Amendment doesn't contain the words reasonable suspicion. It doesn't contain the word. It contains the words probable cause, but it doesn't say that stops or arrests have to be based on probable cause. The Fourth Amendment was written at a time when we were a tiny rural society huddled along the eastern seaboard. It has nothing to tell us about what kind of police actions ought to be occurring in 21st century urban America. So the way we ought to approach that problem is not by trying to figure out what the words of the Fourth Amendment mean or what the framers intended. The way we ought to approach it is to try to think about whether New York stop and frisk policy is an effective way of controlling crime, whether it violates individual rights that we think are important, whether it's racially discriminatory, whether it makes people feel like they're not full citizens. In other words, we ought to have a discussion about what's going on now, not what was going on 250 years ago in a country that's just radically different from the country we now live in.
But it's that one aspect of the list that you gave, violating people's individual rights. And by the way, I want to apologize in advance for how short the segment is going to be, because we did go long with stop and frisk. But if the Constitution is not the standard for what is seen under the law as violating people's individual rights, what would it be?
Well, we have notions about that that are independent of the Constitution. So, look, in 1853, it was perfectly clear that the Constitution did not recognize the individual rights of slaves. But we had great Americans, people like William Lloyd Garrison and so on, abolitionists, who said, whatever's in the Constitution, slavery violates individual rights. It's not like our individual rights are defined by the Constitution. The Constitution's a document written by flawed human beings.
Right. But on the other hand, the 13th Amendment was the only definitive binding declaration that slavery had been abolished, which, as we actually brought up in an earlier segment on the show this hour, why Lincoln and Thaddeus Stevens were fighting so hard for it. So who's to stop slavery without a Constitution?
Brian, I'm going to have to disagree with you. The beginnings of the end of slavery were not the 13th Amendment. It was Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. And the Emancipation Proclamation was, I think most people would agree, an unconstitutional act. It was the understanding of almost everybody at the time that the Constitution prohibited interference with slavery in places where it already existed. Lincoln made a threadbare argument that it was constitutional as a temporary war measure, but pretty early on, he came to recognize what most people understood when it was issued, which was that it wasn't a temporary measure at all. It was meant to be permanent.
So the Emancipation Proclamation was an act of constitutional disobedience.
Exactly. As was some of the other great events in the American history. For example, Thomas Jefferson himself thought that the Louisiana Purchase was unconstitutional. He went ahead and did it anyway because he thought it was good for the country, and I think we can all be grateful for it, to both him and Lincoln, that they disregarded the Constitution where it didn't make any sense.
In the contemporary context, in our last minute or so, in whose interest would ignoring the Constitution be? This can't just be good government abstraction. Legal changes have consequences. People win and lose. Interest groups win and lose, as you know. Have you costed any of this out?
I can't predict what exactly would happen in a world where the Constitution was ignored. What I can say is that the interests of people alive today would finally trump the interests of people who've been dead for 200 years and who have no right to rule us today. So this is a matter of taking back America for the people who live in this country now, who have the right to have their own country and not a country imagined by folks who are long dead.
Louis Michael Seidman is a professor of law at Georgetown University's Law School, and his book is called On Constitutional Disobedience. Very provocative. Thank you for making us think.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Your thoughts, folks, on constitutional disobedience? Post them to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Your thoughts on stop and frisk? WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show.